You're listening to the Reasonable Faith Virtual Chapter Podcast. In this podcast, you'll hear the audio from one of our live discussions. Please join the discussion at reasonablefaithvirtual.org. Okay, so first of all, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate you being here. If you're joining online through the podcast later, you can join our server at reasonablefaithvirtual.org. And tonight, we're going to be talking about fine-tuning arguments for God's existence. Now, in order to understand fine-tuning arguments, we're going to need to understand what fine-tuning is. So the slide that you see here, this is a scientific model. This one happens to be about gravity. I got this from physicists Luke Barnes and Grant Lewis in their book, Fortunate Universe. And what you'll see is you've got the equation for the gravitational force there in the center. And into that, we plug the gravitational constant on the left side. At the top, we plug in facts about the mass objects, perhaps their size, their velocity, that sort of thing. On the right, we'll plug in the scenario that these mass objects are in. So maybe one is headed perpendicular to the second one, and the second one's headed straight at the first one, whatever the case may be. And if we plug all of that in, and this is obviously a simplified drawing, but if we plug all that in, then we'll get a prediction. And maybe it's going to predict the way that a meteor is going to pass through our solar system or something like that. And what we can do is we can vary the scenario, we can vary the values of the mass objects, and we're going to get different predictions. And we can verify these through observation in our universe, or they can set up experiments in the lab. And over, we try this model and we get predictions, and the predictions match the model's predictions. And so through that process, we become justified and we show more and more that these scientific models are reliable. And so what theoretical physicists do is they can say, well, look, we can vary at the top, we can vary the right side, we can also vary the left side, the gravitational constant, and we're going to get a valid prediction because we've already shown that this model produces valid predictions. And what they found was that in a number of constants and quantities, I think Luke Barnes has said there's something like 10 or more, something like that, in a number of constants and quantities, if they vary only slightly, then life becomes completely impossible throughout the universe. And it's not just a universe that's life hostile, like a geothermal vent at the bottom of the ocean, but life impossible. These are scenarios where the only atoms in the universe are hydrogen atoms. It's just an inert gas that doesn't react with anything. And whatever you want to call life, a hydrogen gas is not it. Or it could be that all of the matter in the universe collapses back into a singularity, or that the mass expands so quickly that no stars or planets form. And so there's no planets on which life could form, but also there's no denser elements because denser elements need to be cooked in stars. So you never get to things like carbon or anything like that with that can have as many bonds as something like carbon does. And so these end up being universes where there's just no chemistry, there's no possibility for life. Now, how narrow of a range are these? Well, I'll give you three examples. And in order to kind of understand the proportion, I first want you to imagine that you have a dial. You know, I got a dial there in the picture. And let's say that your dial has 10 positions on it. Well, if you turn the dial one position, then you've turned it 1 in 10, right? Now imagine that you had a dial that had a position on it for every second that has elapsed since the Big Bang. So not just since the Earth began to exist, not since life began to exist, since the Big Bang, the entire history of the universe, you would have 10 to the 19 positions on that dial. So you turn it once, that's 1 in 10 to the 19. Now imagine that you have one of these dials for every second that the universe has been in existence. For every second in the universe, you have a different dial. So you have 10 to the 19 dials, each with 10 to the 19 positions. Then imagine you turned one of those dials one position, that would be 1 in 10 to the 38, which would still be two orders of magnitude smaller than the gravitational constant, which is finely tuned within one part in 10 to the 40. So you move more than one part in 10 to the 40, and life is impossible through the universe. The cosmological constant that relates to the speed at which the universe is expanding is finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 120. And the initial low entropy state was calculated by Sir Roger Penrose, an agnostic, and he said it's finely tuned to one in 10 to the 10 to the 123. It's just an unimaginably small number. So if these constants and quantities vary even slightly, then life is completely impossible. And this remarkable fine-tuning is what we call it. We call it fine-tuning phenomenon. And then arguments for fine-tuning look at this phenomenon and say, well, we can infer God's existence from this. And so we'll go ahead now and look at some of those. The first is the deductive argument. And this is far and away the most popular. And it goes, premise one, fine-tuning is due to necessity, design, or chance. Premise two, fine-tuning is not due to chance or necessity. Therefore, number three, fine-tuning is due to design. Now, that is a true trilemma. So you can divide the probability table. On the left side, you'll have necessity, and on the right side is not necessity. So necessity or not necessity covers all of the values. And then within the not necessity portion, you can say, okay, well, they didn't have to be these values. So they were either happened to be these values or they didn't just happen to be these values, which is they were made to be these values. And so you've got chance or design splitting up the non-necessity portions of the table. So that is actually a true trilemma. But I'm not going to say a whole lot about the deductive form of the argument just because there is so much information available online. When we get to the group discussion, feel free to raise any questions or objections you have about it. But I'm not going to say any more in the presentation. As I said, we've got limited time and there's just a ton of available information. So if you go on YouTube and search reasonable faith fine-tuning, you'll find tons of videos on this argument. So then what we'll do is we'll go ahead and move on to the Bayesian argument. And this argument is, this argument is convoluted to say the least. So that's Bayes' theorem there at the top. It is a little bit difficult to read. And so what I've done is the formula below, I've kind of substituted in single letter variables because the PR is probability of, and then in the parentheses is the thing that is the probability of. So on the left side, you'll see PR, open parentheses, H, vertical line E, right? So what that means is the probability of H, and then the line means given E. So the probability of the hypothesis given the evidence. And that's what Bayes' theorem helps us to calculate, is what is the probability of our hypothesis given the evidence that we're offering for that hypothesis. In order to get there, you do that whole mess on the right. But as I've done in the second one, where I plugged in sort of more simple variables, you can actually see that despite everything that's going on in the formula, there's really only four variables, and really only three variables that you need in order to get to your conclusion. So you need H, which I've substituted for PR of H, but H, which is the prior probability of the hypothesis. So what's the probability that this hypothesis is true before we view this evidence? And that's going to give you the not H, the not probability. And that's because H and not H have to add up to one. And so the probability of not H is going to be one minus the probability of H. So if you've got H, you can infer not H. The next variable that you need is the probability of the evidence given the hypothesis. So if you assume that the hypothesis is true, then, you know, what's the likelihood that you'll see the evidence if that hypothesis is true? And then the last one there is, what's the evidence given not the hypothesis? So if we assume that the hypothesis is false, what's the likelihood that we'll have this evidence? Now, a really good video that goes in depth into Bayes' theorem, if you're not familiar with it, is available on the Analytic Christian. Dr. Thomas Bogardus goes over it. The actual video is, the title of it is about consciousness, but he goes very in depth into Bayes' theorem. He uses dice rolls to kind of show how this theorem works and why it works. And so if you're not sure about Bayes' theorem, that's a great place to go. But suffice it to say, for our purposes, if you plug in the hypothesis, these two other evidence-based ones, then what you're going to get is the probability of the hypothesis given the evidence. And we want to know what's the extent to which the evidence sways the hypothesis. So you have your prior probability. What do you think the likelihood is of the hypothesis before coming to the evidence? And then we want to see, okay, well, given that starting point, what should your conclusion be? And we'll see the amount that the evidence should sway you, and then you'll see how strong the evidence is. So let's go ahead and plug in some values. First of all, we need to define our hypothesis here, and it's design. It's just like in the deductive argument, what we're saying is that God made these values to be what they are. And so our hypothesis is divine design for our fine tuning. And then obviously the not hypothesis would be not divine design or not design for the hypothesis. So what's the probability of the hypothesis, your prior probability. What do you think the likelihood is that God designed our universe to have these fine-tuning values before you examine the fine-tuning? And let's say you're incredibly skeptical. Well, let's say that you're just, you know, very strongly atheistic. You think almost certainly God doesn't exist and certainly didn't design the universe, or perhaps you're persuaded by so-called bad design arguments or the like, or the problem of evil, whatever the case may be. And let's say that you think it's 1 in 100 million that God did not design this universe. So, you know, 0.000001 is what we're going to go with for the prior probability of the hypothesis. Well, what's the probability of the evidence that's fine-tuning given the hypothesis? Well, that's going to be 1. And the reason why is our hypothesis is that God made the fine-tuning to be what it is. And so if God made the fine-tuning to be what it is, then what's the probability of it? Well, that's going to be 1, because God couldn't fail in bringing about the fine-tuning. Given the qualities of God, he wouldn't fail in doing so. And so our probability of the evidence given the hypothesis is going to be 1. So what's the probability of the evidence given, not the hypothesis? What's the probability if God is not involved in making these constants and quantities have their values? Well, as we saw in the beginning of the discussion here, the odds of these things happening by chance alone is astronomically small. I mean, hundreds of zeros before you get to the 1, almost 0. And so what you find if you plug all that into the Bayes' theorem is, what's the probability of the hypothesis now given the evidence? It's going to work out to be 1. And so you can go from absolutely skeptical to almost certain that God designed the universe, because the fine-tuning evidence is that strong. Now, some of you may be saying, hold up, hang on. You didn't consider necessity. What about necessity? If necessity is true, then it's also 1. And isn't that a not God-designed hypothesis? And what I would say about necessity is that it should be dismissed from our consideration. Now, there's a few different theories that we dismiss, and we don't even consider them. We don't assign them a probability. They just don't make it into our considerations. So let me give you a couple examples. One is that the fine-tuning is a result of human perception. And so the fine-tuning exists because humans think it exists, right? That's a hypothesis. I mean, it's I've strung words together in a coherent way. But that seems obviously false, because the universe existed before humans were here. And so we wouldn't even bother trying to find out what the probability of that is. We would just dismiss it out of hand, like, well, that's obviously false. Another one would be that the universe doesn't exist. So there's no fine-tuning because there's no universe. There's no you, there's no me, nothing exists. We're in the nothing world where nothing exists. Well, we wouldn't even consider that, because obviously the world exists. I mean, here you and I are, we're talking. And so we would just dismiss that one out of hand and not consider it. And I think that necessity is in that boat, is in the boat of, this is not worth consideration. Now, why do I say that? So first of all, we have to realize that the universe is contingent. And so there actually is no thing that is the gravitational constant. The gravitational constant describes how matter behaves. So it's not like there's this thing that can exist necessarily. There's just the matter, and then these are like true descriptions of the matter. But the matter began to exist, and you can't have necessary facts about contingent objects. You can have you can have facts that are essential to those objects, but you can't have necessary facts about contingent objects, because there are possible worlds where those objects don't exist, and so it wouldn't be necessary then. You'd have to have the objects themselves being necessary, which is problematic for a number of reasons. And so we do have a contingent universe. It began to exist 15 billion years ago, which shows that the matter is not necessary, and then therefore you can't have necessarily true facts about the matter. So right off the gate, that's almost as absurd as, well, obviously the universe is here, and so we needn't consider the hypothesis that it isn't. Secondly, we've got what's called modal collapse. And modal collapse is wildly against our intuitions. It seems to us like we don't just live in a world that could be the world that exists. It seems like we live in a world where there's a lot of different possibilities. It doesn't seem like this is the only world. The way things are in this world is the only way things could be. It seems like things could be different. So if you ate 8 blueberries for breakfast, seems like you could have stopped at 7, or you could have eaten a 9th blueberry, right? It's just how the world seems to us. In fact, modal collapse is often used as a reductio ad absurdum. And so you'll show that a line of reasoning leads to modal collapse, and then that'll be a reason to reject that line of reasoning. Secondly, we encounter duties. And these are in a few different forms. One is moral duties. So you have the duty not to rape someone, for example, the moral duty. You also have epistemic duties. So we'd say that you ought to believe something when it's logically proven, let's say. And ought implies can. And so if we really do have these moral or epistemic duties, well, if you ought to do something, that implies you can do it. But if modal collapse is true, then there's only what you do is the only thing that you can do. And so there is no you ought to do something else, or you ought to do something differently, or you ought to believe something differently. And so modal collapse militates against those intuitions about duties as well. And finally, there's an epistemic concern where we really wouldn't want to admit necessity for epistemic reasons. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you ask, if somebody says, well, these constants and quantities, they're just necessarily are what they are. Never mind the fact that some of them, like entropy, are changing. They're just necessary. Well, then the question would be, okay, well, why are they necessarily these values instead of necessarily some other set of values? And really, that's going to be end up being a brute fact. It's going to be just, they just are what they are, and there's no explanation at all. And when you have necessity and brute fact, when you're appealing to that to explain phenomena in all world, the problem is that that appeal will work with any hypothesis. So let's say that I gave the hypothesis that the sun doesn't exist, that there is no sun in the center of our solar system. Well, you would say, okay, but if there's no sun, it's really unlikely that we're going to have sunlight coming to the Earth, and really unlikely that we're going to have this gravitational pull around this point in space. And my response is, well, those data points, it's just necessarily the case that the sunlight's showing up, and inexplicably, there's just brute fact that the sunlight's showing up, and it's just a necessary brute fact that we're, you know, orbiting that point in space. You can't ask me to explain it because it's a brute fact. There's no explanation. You can see there's a problem there. There would be a bit of a problem there. And so if there's a problem there, then there's a problem with making that move with fine tuning as well. And so for epistemic reasons, if there's any, you know, theory that's an alternate to necessity plus brute fact, then we'd probably want to go with that for those reasons. And then even if you don't buy any of that, let's say that you don't agree with anything that I'm saying about necessity, then what we can do is we would alter our hypothesis so that it would be that the hypothesis is going to be either God designed it or necessity. It's going to be either God designed it or necessity. And then what we'll end up with is we'll have to say, okay, well, which should we prefer, necessity or divine design? And what we'd say is that design is a better explanation of the evidence than is necessity. And we'll get into that in the next argument, which is the abductive argument, which is sort of where that one leads. And now this one, the abductive argument, it says, what's the best explanation? And it says that the best explanation of fine-tuning is that God designed it this way. And it has kind of two stages to it. So step one is that we infer design from specified complexity. I'll explain what that is in a minute. And then stage two, once we've inferred design, we do a conceptual analysis to see what sort of designer, what are the qualities of this designer, and we end up with God. In fact, I was talking with David from PhilTalk on a show someplace, and he's the one who actually did that conceptual analysis, because it seems if there is a designer of the universe, it must be God. And so what is specified complexity? Well, it's, number one, it's complex, which means it's going to have multiple different data points. And two, it's going to be specified, which means that the complexity matches or mirrors some external set of criteria. And I say external because it can't be criteria that caused the complexity, but it's got to be external to itself. So let me give you a few examples. So a key, for example, it has a number of different bumps. At least, you know, this key has two for whatever reason, but let's say it's got a number of different bumps. And the bumps on the key match the tumblers in the lock. And it's external to the key because it's not like the lock caused the bumps on the key. They were made independently, but one matches the other. And so we'd say that they're specified because they're not related, and it's complex because there's multiple data points. If you enter a password, you've got a bunch of different characters, and that matches the external set of criteria, which is the what's saved in the database. If you've used a debit card, you use specified complexity. It's your PIN number, and that's going to be four different data points, and it matches what's on file with the bank. language is specify complexity. So here I've got SOS written in the sand. There's a bunch of different data points, like the particular curves and the way the sand is swirled. There's a bunch of different data points that make up this SOS, and it matches human language. Now, human language didn't cause the writing in the sand. Neither did the writing of the sand cause us to have this human language. And so it's external to the writing in the sand that you see. And also machinery. So, you know, if you have a piece of machinery that does some purpose, maybe it's, a screwdriver. Well, it's specified to a purpose. It fits this purpose exactly well. And the screw that's sitting in the wood didn't assemble the screwdriver. And so it's external to it. And what we'd say then is whenever we encounter specified complexity, we're justified in inferring design. We encounter specified complexity all the time. In fact, we use specified complexity in order to determine design. And so when we come to fine tuning, it is complex. There's a bunch of different data points. There's some 10 or so different constants and quantities in nature. And they're specified to the needs of conscious embodied life. Now, life didn't cause the constants and quantities to have the values that they do. Neither did the constants and quantities cause life to need things like planets and chemistry. And so it is external and it is complex. And so it would be an example of specified complexity. And so we would infer design. And then if we're still going back to necessity, we're considering necessity. Necessity is going to be a weaker explanation for a few reasons. One, because we are going with brute fact, it literally doesn't have an explanation. And so it fails in explanatory power. It's also implausible because the constants are not universal things. Like there's not some G that goes around and checks on all the matter and makes it have a particular attractive force. It's actually true of every bit of matter that it follows this law. So it'd be really strange for all of the matter to just happen to exert the same forces. And even though it's matter that's over here or over there, they're different pieces of matter. And yet they have the same gravitational force. Now, if they all had the same origin, it makes sense. But that isn't how, and that would make sense in theism that they would have the same origin. So there's a number of deficiencies in necessity. Like I said, with implausibility as well, it goes back to our modal intuitions, assuming to have a world that has different, that could go differently than it has. So then we come to the conceptual analysis. So imagine we're playing a game of guess who. We think of the designer who designed the universe. Well, first of all, he's going to have to be immaterial because he's designing the material universe. So it can be made of matter since he's designing matter. It's intelligent because design is an act of intelligence. He's going to be enormously powerful to design a universe. I couldn't just snap my fingers and have a universe. So he's enormously powerful. He's incredibly intelligent. Wise, because you'd need a lot of working knowledge or applicable knowledge in order to do such a thing, and obviously a lot of knowledge. If I were playing Guess Who with you and I said, well, I'm the immaterial, powerful, intelligent creator and designer of the universe, if you don't guess God, then you and I are not going to be on the same team anymore. You know, it seems obviously, who are we talking about? Obviously, we're talking about God. And so for those reasons, I do think that the fine-tuning argument gives us good reason to believe that God exists. And we needn't think that these three arguments that are presented they have to stand alone. They can be different lenses or different ways of looking at fine-tuning that give us the theistic implications. So with that, that's the end of the short presentation here. What we'll go ahead and do now is I'm going to go ahead and close the stage, and then we'll go down to open discussion. If you have any questions, any concerns or anything like that, or objections, we'll just talk about it together in the open discussion. So thank you for listening, and I'll see you down there in just a minute. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Reasonable Faith Virtual Chapter Podcast. If you'd like to join the discussion, please join us at reasonablefaithvirtual.org.